What's up, my friend? Welcome to the Finding Direction podcast. My name is Stu Massengill, and I'm here every single week to bring you a passionate guest or message dedicated to helping you find your purpose so that you can live a life full of passion, fulfillment, and happiness. From the bottom of my heart, thank you for hanging out with me, and let's dive in. What's up, my friend? Welcome back to the show. This week, I am sitting down with Laura Gassner Odding, and a little bit about her. She is a best-selling author. She's a catalyst. She is an executive coach and a keynote speaker who is pushing people and inspiring people to push past their self-doubt and to ultimately think bigger. She is a former presidential appointee to Bill Clinton, where she helped form AmeriCorps. She is a law school dropout, which you will definitely hear about. And she is the former founder of one of the largest growing search firms in the company, which she went on to ultimately sell in 2015. And in this episode, a few of the things that we talk about is why you have to ignore everybody else's plan for you in your life. We also talk about how the big pivots in your life are absolutely necessary. And we discuss how success is both wonderful, but it is also hell. So there is a lot of goodness in this episode. If you have not yet, make sure you hit that subscribe button so you can join us on the show every single week. And without further ado, my friend, here we go. Laura Gassner Odding, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Stu, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. And so as we dive into our conversation, I would love it if you could give sort of the plane ride view to the journey of life that you've sort of gone through to get you to where you are today. I know you've had a lot of ups, downs, a lot of sort of twists and turns you've taken, but I would love it if you could give us a little bit of a kind of the plane ride, 10,000 foot view of what that journey looked like.
So I can tell you the story in one of two ways. I can either tell you the story from now backwards, telling you how everything was strategic and smart and planned and intentional, or I could tell you the real story, which is that I completely, blindly, accidentally found my way from there to here.
Yeah,
what do you think?
Let's go with the raw, the real, the stumbles.
Perfect.
That's a beautiful one, yeah.
Because here's the thing. I spent 20 years in executive search interviewing the most successful people in the world. And I will tell you, Stu, that the most interesting, actually, let me rephrase that. The only interesting people I talked to were the ones who had left turns and right turns and U-turns, because it's the stumbles and the bumbles that actually make us interesting. That's actually where we learn what we care about and who we are and who we care about. So yes, like it's so easy to look at people, like everything that we see in the sort of like success hustle porn universe is this person had this great idea in their garage and now they're a billionaire, right? But they don't tell you about like the messy middle. So let's talk about that. When I was in fourth grade, I had a teacher who told me I was a really argumentative young woman and I should become a lawyer. And of course, the first thing I said to her was she was wrong because, you know, I was argumentative.
You're argumentative, yeah.
I was argumentative. But then I, in my head, I subconsciously and later consciously created a path that got me to law school, where on the very first day, I was like, I don't want to be a lawyer. I don't like any of these other students. I'm not interested in what the teachers are lecturing about. Like, I don't want to be here. This is a huge mistake. So I did what most people would do, most women especially do when we've made huge mistakes in our lives, that we date terrible, terrible men. And what most straight women would do. I dated this terrible guy and I joke around that he had exceptionally exquisite taste in precisely two things. The first, obviously, being girlfriends. But the second being unknown presidential hopefuls from tiny southern states. And one day when he was driving me home from campus, he's like, I want to stop at this guy's campaign office. He's running for president. And I was like, Governor who? From where? Arkansas, like not a chance in hell. George H.W. Bush had just won Desert Storm. Like there was no way this guy was going to win. But we walked into the campaign office and there was this teeny tiny TV and he was telling about this idea. Bill Clinton was talking about this idea of community service in exchange for college tuition. And I was like, oh my God, that needs to happen. So I dropped out of law school. I joined the campaign. He ended up in the White House. I ended up in the White House. I helped create the AmeriCorps program. I spent 4 years doing that. Pretty incredible time to like be like 22 years old and working in the White House, like an incredibly heady romantic moment. And then I wanted to go back out on the campaign trail. But my boss at the time, who had run the 92 campaign, said, you know, Laura, you're kind of too old to get back on campaign buses and sleep on high school gymnasium floors and eat cold pizzas. Because, you know, like 25 in campaigns is like dog years. I might as well be like 104, right? So He's like, you're too old to do that. And you're too young to be the domestic policy advisor. So go talk to my friend, Arnie Miller. He runs the biggest search firm in the country that does specifically nonprofit work. He'll find you a job in a nonprofit. You'll hide out for 4 years. You'll come back and do something big on the Gore campaign. And I said, great. I went to go talk to Arnie. And about 5 minutes into the conversation with Arnie, I was like, your office is in Boston, isn't it? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, okay, well, the guy I'm dating now, who is not the terrible guy, who's actually the one, right? We just celebrated 25 years of marriage.
Amazing.
He's about to move to Boston. Maybe I should come work for you. And Arnie said, you should come work for me. And I was like, great. What do you do? And that's how I became a headhunter. I spent 5 years working for Arnie, learning from the best and the brightest about how to do this work in a way that is, you know, just like the top of class. Until one day I had this moment of rage where I was like, this work can be done better, with more authenticity, more integrity, more profit for me, but less cost for my client, a better work-life balance. Like, why don't we do it differently? And I walked into Arnie's office and I was like, there's a better way. And he was like, there's the door. And basically he said, look, we love you. You're great. You could stay here and keep doing the work our way. But if you want to do it your way, you got to leave. And in that moment, Stu, I realized that I wasn't part of my client's solution, which meant I was only part of their problem. So I did the Jerry Maguire thing with my manifesto and my fish, and I walked out the door and I founded my own firm. And I spent 15 years running that firm until I sold it to the women who helped me build it. And then I left, right? I sold it to them. I left. I had a really successful exit. Didn't know what I wanted to do next. But one day I was the chair of a charity auction, an art auction for a local organization. And I didn't want to get up on stage and speak because that's terrifying. And so my good friend, Janet Wu, who's a local newscaster, said, I'll do it for you. She gets up on stage. She goes, I'd like to thank my dear friend, Laura Gassner Otting, who dedicates her life to philanthropy. And I was like, oh my God, I just sold my business, so I'm technically unemployed. I'm wearing this like fancy dress and these fancy jewels from like the jewelry and the couture fashion sponsors for this event. And I'm looking at my husband and I was like, oh my God, she just lady who lunched me. I'm a lady who lunches. Like, oh my God, like there's nothing wrong with dedicating your life to philanthropy. And I had done that, but it was only one dimension of who I am. So I went home that night and I bought lauragassnerotting.com. I started blogging about stuff that was bothering me in the world. And the head of TEDx Cambridge called me up and said, hey, I just read one of your blog posts. That would make a great talk. Do you want to give a TEDx talk? And I said, no effing way. That's terrifying. Don't want to do it. Never spoke. Don't want to speak. Not going to do it. My kids are in the back seat and they're like, Mom, don't you always tell us we got to do things that scare us?
Yeah.
So what gives, Mom? And I was like, ugh. Like, you don't listen to me tell you to pick up your socks, but that you heard. So 6 weeks later, I'm on the stage. That talk got some attention. I got offered money to go places to go speak. And they handed me money after I finished talking. And then I was like, oh, well, that's cool. And that brings me up to my job today, where I'm an author and a keynote speaker.
Yeah. Beautifully, beautifully laid out.
There's no through line. There's no strategy. It's just do interesting things with interesting people and interesting opportunities arise.
I like it. And one thing, you know, that you touched on the beginning that I think is so powerful is that you said from all these people that you spoke with, all these people you worked with, it was the people that had this twist, the turns, all of that who were living an interesting and a happy life. And I think a lot of the time we can perceive life as the exact opposite of that, right? It's like, well, if I have this moment in my life where I'm in law school and I'm all of a sudden like, okay, this isn't what I want to do anymore. It's like, we look at ourselves and go, well, am I a failure? Because I spent all this time and energy and all this part of my life pursuing law just to realize that law is actually not the thing that I want to do.
So yeah. And you know, if you are a scientist and you have a theory about something and then you spend a whole bunch of time disproving that theory, are you a failure? Or are you just somebody who has figured out more stuff about a new potential theory, right? That's called progress in science.
Yeah.
When we think about it in terms of our lives, we're like, oh, I must be a failure. You know, it's interesting. My I have two kids, and my eldest son is a sophomore in college, and he went off his freshman year of college as an Air Force ROTC mechanical engineering student, right? He wanted to fly in space, and he wanted to fly fighter jets, and that's what he wanted to do. And he gets there, and on day one, he was like, what if I don't do this? I've kind of been having second thoughts, and I didn't want to tell anybody, but what if I don't do it? And he calls me up, and he's like, what if I don't do it? I'm like, then you don't do it. And he says, won't people, like, everybody knows me as, like, Benji the pilot. Like, I'm the kid who wants to fly in space. Like, and it was so funny because my first book, Limitless, is all of, like, it's literally called Limitless, How to Ignore Everybody, Carve Your Own Path, and Live Your Best Life. And I was like, well, you know, I've got a book you might want to read, son. But, you know, even, like, like everybody feels this way. Even the kid of the person who spends her life saying, like, it doesn't matter. Like, my favorite Eleanor Roosevelt quote is, we'd worry much less about what other people thought about us if we realized how seldomly they did. Nobody's paying attention. Like, nobody is sitting there thinking, oh, Laura's kid is no longer the mechanical engineering pilot, Air Force ROTC. Like, he's an art major now. He's a failure. Like, nobody's thinking that because nobody's thinking about him. Nobody's thinking about me. Nobody's thinking about you. Like, nobody's paying that much attention. And, you know, I think that we overestimate how much people care about what we're doing and how much they're paying attention. And I think we also overestimate how permanent the decisions are that we make.
Can you speak more about that?
So there's a as I mentioned, I do keynote speaking for a living, and there's a part of my talk where I talk about how failure is not finale, it's fulcrum, right? It is the place where we learn and we grow and we change and we iterate and we innovate. Like, think about every failure you've ever had. Was it the end? Was it the dead end? Like, are you 6 feet under? No, like, you have survived all of your bad days and you've learned the lesson. And frankly, when you go to cocktail parties, my guess is you don't walk into a cocktail party and be like, my name is Stu and let me tell you about the greatest thing I ever did. You tell the story about when you face planted, when you fell apart, when everything went wrong, because that's the funny story. That's the entertaining story. And everybody likes the victory, but they want to know that you had the work and the struggle to get to it, right? So if you just walk in and you're all victory, people are like, oh, who's the gas bag? Like, nobody cares. But if you talk about, you know, and if you walk in and you're all struggle, nobody cares. But if you can tell, like, the hero's journey, that's amazing. You're an incredible storyteller. Everybody wants you as a guest at the party. So I have this line in my talk where I'm like, failure's not finale, it's fulcrum. And one day I was giving this talk and I looked down at stage right, and the first row was Commander Tim Kopra of NASA. And Commander Tim Kopra of NASA has gone on not one, not two, but three spacewalks, because I don't know, he's a show off or something, but three spacewalks. And I was like, failure's not finale, it's fulcrum. Except for you, sir. But for the rest of us, right? If you are not, like, performing open heart surgery, right? Or you are not like an EMT, like trying to resuscitate an overdose victim. If you are not an astronaut on a spacewalk, your failure is not finale. It is just the place from which you get better. And the other thing I'll say is that when I was interviewing all of these thousands of people, the ones that told me about the failures and said, yeah, but it was my boss's fault, or I didn't have the resources, or, you know, they pulled the plug on the project, who didn't learn from it, that was a problem. But the ones who could turn the lens on themselves, the ones who could tell me what they learned from the process and how it wouldn't happen again, that's how I knew that the speed from failure to fix was actually very short, and that those were people who weren't failures, they were learners.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the good old adage where they say you never fail, you just win or you learn, right? And the key is, how do you learn at a faster rate? And I think one interesting thing too, you know, that's been a, I mean, you nailed it on the head when you say you want to look at this process of life that you're going through like a scientist. And one thing that recently I've been just such a believer in and diving into is this idea that as you're figuring out what you want to do with your life, it's essentially like you are a scientist with a hypothesis, right?
Yes.
And for your son, his hypothesis for 20 some years, 19, however, until he was, you know, a freshman, his hypothesis was, with my life, I believe that I am going to be, you know, doing stuff with space, and that's going to be my life. And then finally, he worked on the hypothesis a little bit more. And he goes, wait a second. This is the wrong hypothesis. My new hypothesis is I'm going to go into art or whatever he ended up doing next. But I think if we allow ourselves to look at it through this lens, and like you said, not this necessarily permanent thing where we're caring so much about what other people think, it gives us this sort of grace that we can use to travel from one thing to the next. And it can make the journey a little bit easier.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, when I dropped out of law school, I had saved money like scooping ice cream and changing bedpans in hospitals all through high school and college so I could go to Europe, so I could put a backpack on my back and go to Europe. And right before I went, so in between the first semester and the second semester of law school, I went to Europe and I backpacked around. And at that point, I knew I wanted to leave. I knew I was miserable and I didn't want to do it. And I remember calling my parents. And again, this is like in the 90s. So I called my parents with like, you know, from a payphone in the basement of a hostel. I was in Vienna and I was in the basement of a hostel, and there was like a whole like row of payphones. And I remember going in, calling my parents from Austria to tell them I wanted to quit law school because I was afraid if I did it anywhere closer, they would fly there and find me and murder me, right? Like I was so afraid of what they would think. But the truth is I was so incredibly miserable when I was there. And, you know, it was so clear it wasn't right for me. My parents, who were not the most understanding or flexible people, they said to me, fine, we'll give you 6 months. We'll pay your rent for 6 months in DC, which like at the time was like $275 a month. Cause you know, again, it was the early 90s. We'll pay your, and I was living in an English basement apartment, which sounds very quaint, but it's basically like the basement of a row house that you have like the little half windows. So like it's kind of like in like a cell. And it was like me and my roommate and her boyfriend who never showered, and a bunch of like roaches and rats. And like, that's where I live. They're like, we'll give you 6 months rent. The dream, I was living the dream. We'll give you 6 months rent. You take care of food. You take care of like beer, like whatever else going out. Like you have to figure out how to pay for that. If you don't have a paying job in 6 months, you have to come back to law school. So you better bet your ass I was incentivized, right? I was incentivized to be able to make it work.
To make something happen.
But because they gave me that freedom, they gave me 6 months to figure it out, I was able to do it. But I was so terrified that they wouldn't understand. And, you know, fast forward, a year later, my parents come to visit me in Washington, D.C. I take them on a tour of the White House. I show them the Oval Office. And, you know, my mom says to me, you know, we haven't seen you smile in a year. Like, this is the first time I've seen you smile in a year. And so it took some time for them to realize. And my father, who, by the way, is a rabid Republican, who was not happy I was leaving law school, nor that I was going to work for Bill Clinton. He was not so happy about seeing me smile there. But I'm 52 right now. And a couple of years ago, I was with my dad and I made some comment like, everybody makes plans, but your plans don't work out. My plan didn't work out for law school. And my dad actually piped up from the backseat of the car, that's because it wasn't your plan, it was our plan. And I was like, oh, 30 years it took him to be okay with it, right? So like, there are a lot of people in your world who are going to have issues with you when you figure out who you are. But for a lot of them, they don't even know who you are. Like, my parents have my best interest at heart, absolutely. But they don't know my heart. I mean, the last time I lived in the same house with them, I was 17 years old. I didn't have a frontal lobe. Like, I used to bring the car back late for curfew, of course, with, you know, the radio turned all the way up, but the gas turned all the way down. So my parents would get in the car the next morning and it was like, quiet riot, like, you know, but like they couldn't drive to work. So when I told them I was like dropping out of law school or leaving the White House or leaving the big safe firm or even selling my business, they were like, what are you doing? You can't do that. That's a problem. Because they didn't know me. So I think a lot of times it's not that people are doubting us. It's that we're listening to all of them on equal footing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for our listener, it's a good moment to ask themselves, like, is there somebody's opinion? Is there somebody's commentary that you're trying to follow? And one, do you need to stop caring about what they think you should do? Or number two, do you just need to have a conversation with them? Right. I know in my own life, I had a period where I left school and I came back, and literally a month after I came back, I decided to leave again. And I had a similar conversation with my parents. It was like, hey, you convinced me to go back to school and I'm leaving again for this other reason. And I was so terrified to have that conversation because from what I've seen, it's like we are so much more afraid of having the conversation than actually having it. And for me, when yes. I finally had it, it was a similar thing where it was like, okay, you know what? If that's your heart, like follow it. And it was like, you're not going to kill me? Like, you know? And I think sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't go that well, but we need to at least have the conversation to know, are we going to get a 6-month trial period to go do this thing? Are we going to, like, we just need to know what's going to happen so then we can take the next step. And so, obviously, oh, go ahead.
I say, like, you know, I think for my parents, they had always assumed that I would become a lawyer. They wanted me to go to law school.
Yeah.
So for them, that was the definition of success for a couple of reasons. Number one, they thought it was secure, right? It was a secure job.
Sure.
Number two, they could show off to their friends and be like, my daughter, the lawyer, right? So what are their incentives? What are their, like, what are their motivations? And so when I was able to think about that, I was able to say, okay, if they want me to be safe and secure, that means they want me to have a paying job, right? They want me to have a pathway. They want to show off to their friends while I'm working in the White House. That's pretty good show off to your friends, right? So if I could sit down and have the conversation with them and say, I know that it's upsetting to you that I'm leaving this, but here's what I want to do and why. And not saying, because I know you want to show off to your friends, but to say, because I think that this is going to turn out pretty well. If this guy wins, there's some pretty good job prospects for me in the future, right? So I think it's kind of getting
That's
to the
beautiful.
Why behind the why. And if you can talk to them in their language, you know, for anybody who sells anything, I mean, I'm sitting here, you know, at my desk and I have behind me a tube of like... of moisturizer, right? And the tube of moisturizer says it's got like 5% glycerin and 10% retinol and like all these things. Like if I'm going to walk in and I want to sell you some moisturizer, am I going to say it's got 5% of this and 10% of that and 6% of this? No, I'm going to say this makes you look 10 years younger. And you're like, awesome. That's what I want. Like nobody buys 5%, 10%. They buy the solution to the problem.
Yeah.
So the solution to my parents' problem was your daughter's going to be fine. She's going to be safe and secure and taken care of and have a plan. So the how was less important than the why for them. So I think if we kind of have those conversations differently, they become less scary and more effective.
Yeah. That's a beautiful tool that I think a lot of people can use. So thank you for sharing that.
What's up, my friend? I wanted to jump in here real quick and share with you something that has been a huge game changer in my life lately. If you know me, you know that I'm someone who's always looking for the next thing that helps me get just dialed in, focused, be massively productive, and really just get in this state that I like to call a flow where your brain's talking to the right parts, things are connecting, and you are in just really this beautiful flow throughout your day. And recently, I came across a company that has been helping me with this in a huge way so that I don't go through the day and have confusion. I'm not going through the day and, you know, doing the little squirrel thing where I know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm squirreling to something else or just being distracted and not dialed in really. And the company, it's called Magic Mind. I was introduced to it through a good friend of mine. And now I want to introduce it to you, a good friend of mine. And really what Magic Mind helped me do, it's this little 4-ounce like elixir shot that you take in the morning. You can take it with your coffee. That's personally what I do. And what it does is it helps you start to get in that state of flow. Literally, that's exactly what it does. A few of the ingredients that I'll share specifically that actually are like the process behind what it's doing is one of the big ones that it has in it is matcha. And matcha, really what it does is it contains much, much, much less caffeine than coffee. But what it does is, interestingly enough, and I just learned this recently, it has a compound in it called catechins that basically extend the benefit of caffeine by slowing your body's ability to absorb it. So essentially what matcha is in a nutshell is it's like nature's extended release version of caffeine. And on top of that, it has something called Bacopa manieri, if I'm saying that correctly. And what that is it's a nootropic that improves your attention span, your ability to process and learn new information in your memory. So
long story, all of those different things that I said, really, it just helps you get into a state of flow, be more productive, be more focused, and really just dial in for your day. And so because this has had an impact on my life, I asked the company if they would do something special for our listener. And honestly, they're going to do something just super, super cool, which is if you have an interest in, you know, learning about Magic Mind, you want to be more productive, you want to be more focused, you want to be more dialed in, and you want to find that state of flow for your own life, they're going to basically hook you up for listening to the show and give you 56%. Yes, I said that correctly. 56% off of your first subscription order. And if you just want to do a one-time order, they'll give you 20% off. You can do either way, whatever works best for you. And all you need to do is if you go to magicmind.co, so not com, but .co/direction, and you enter the code direction20 at checkout, you will get both of those discounts. Again, the website is magicmind.co/direction, and just enter the code direction20 at checkout and you'll get 20% off your first time order or 56% off your fourth subscription order. And truly, from my heart to yours, my friend, I really do believe this will help you in life. I hope you believe it'll find direction, get clarity, and live in that state of flow, which honestly, life is so much better and so much more fun when you're living in a state of flow. So go check that out. Go dive into the link. Go check the product out. Use the discount and let me know how you like it, my friend. Back to the show. And, you know, if we continue in your story, eventually you start your own firm. And one of the big things you've talked about, right, is you're calling all these successful people, you know, helping them in their life. And the reason they were calling you back was because although they were successful, they were not necessarily happy. And, you know, now you have a book called Wonder Hell, and it's sort of this idea of you can be very successful, but not necessarily happy. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about, from all these different people you've worked with, you know, what is this sort of idea of Wonder Hell that we put ourselves through sometimes?
So Wonder Hell is this idea that every time we experience success, and it can be big success, like I just sold my first business, or small success, like I just got my first promotion, right? I just sold my first tube of lipstick. I just sold my first contract, right? Like whatever the thing is, it doesn't matter. In that moment of being able to accomplish something, we see a version of ourselves that we weren't even sure was there, right? So it's like, I just sold that first tube of lipstick. Could I sell 10? Could I have 5 people working underneath me, each of whom sell 10, right? Like what could that look like? And so every time we experience success, we feel this like it's amazing, it's exciting, it's humbling, it's wonderful. But also in envisioning that potential future us, it's also anxiety provoking. It's stressful. It's uncertain. It's full of fear and exhaustion and maybe burnout, imposter syndrome, all of these things. So it's wonderful, but it's also kind of hell. It's wonder hell. And so, you know, every time I experience this thing, this like, well, I did this, what else can I do? Not in this like bigger, better, faster, more like keep, you know, crushing it, bro type way, but just in the like, how fascinating that I was able to sub in for my boss and do the presentation. I kind of liked doing the presentation. Maybe I should do more of those presentations. How do I do that? Now I'm noticing all the people in the rung above me all do presentations regularly. So if I could do that, right? So it's like it introduces us to this potential. And it became really clear to me when I was doing executive search that the internal candidates who interviewed for the jobs but didn't get them always left. Now, sometimes it's because they were treated terribly and they were taken advantage of by their employers, but mostly it's because the very process of interviewing for that bigger job meant that they had to literally wear the clothes of that role, speak in the voice of that role, answer questions with the mindset of that role. And when they acted in that role, they couldn't unsee themselves in it. They were like, well, I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah.
If I can't do it here, maybe I should do it somewhere else.
Right. Interesting. And from, you know, all the people that you talked with, like you find someone who's in this place of wonder hell where it's, you know, really awesome and there's a lot of great things, but there's also, again, some of the burdens, the stress, the anxiety, all those things that you take on. So how does somebody start to like work themselves through wonder hell? Or like, how do you get on to the other side of this where it's not this, oh, this is amazing, but this is also kind of hell?
So I found myself in Wonder Hell when Limitless came out. And it debuted at number two on the Washington Post bestseller list. I had I was right behind Michelle Obama, like 8.5 million books behind her. But still, she was number one. I was number two. Like, awesome.
That's
I'll take
pretty
it.
Amazing.
And earlier in the week, I had taken a selfie with Malala because I was keynoting an event that I literally opened for Malala, which is insane. And I had never expected any of this. I thought two people would buy my book. I thought, you know, I was going to toil in anonymity forever. And suddenly it was successful. And then I was like, well, if I could be number two, how do I get to number one? And if I could do Washington Post, how do I do Wall Street Journal? And who sits under the oak tree with Oprah? Because she got to pick someone. Why not me? Right? Yeah. And suddenly I like saw myself and I was like, well, how do I do that? And is that possible? And is that even for me? And could it happen? And in that moment where I felt this wonder hell, I didn't know how to get out of it. And I read every self-help book out there. I learned how to crush it and how to lean in and how to 10X and I stopped apologizing and I washed my face and I did all the things. And none of it worked. And so then I started talking to other people who were like glass ceiling shatterers and Olympic medalists and startup unicorns and everyday people like you and me and your listeners. And what I learned from them was kind of disheartening. You don't actually get out of Wonder Hell. And I was like, well, God, that just sucks. Like, I don't want to be here. This isn't a good place. But what I learned from all the people is that you have a choice. You can either learn to survive it, right? Like buckle down and survive Wonder Hell. Or you could learn to look forward to it and learn from it and plan for it and enjoy it and thrive in it instead. And so here's what I learned. The people who actually enjoyed Wonder Hell, who enjoyed the ride, embraced their ambition. They didn't feel badly. They didn't apologize for it. They said, you know what? I want more. Like everyone says, if you can name it, you can tame it. And they were like, that's horseshit. If you can name it, you can claim it. Like it's okay to want more. It's okay. Like if having more money, more time, more resources, more leverage, more power, more network allows you to show up better for the people you love and the causes you hold dear, that's not your ambition. It's your responsibility. So go for it. Like it is imperative that you embrace that ambition and you go for it. So that's number one. Number two, they renegotiated their relationship with all of the emotions of excitement and fear and joy and uncertainty and promise and potential and possibility and imposter syndrome and like all the things that were coming at them at every single moment. They were like, you know what? Yeah. I could see these things as slings and arrows that I have to absorb and I have to like take them on the chin and I have to just like deal with them. Or I could say, cool, the fact that I feel like an imposter is telling me not, oh my God, you haven't done this before, but oh my God, you haven't done this before. They're not these slings and arrows. They're actually these incredibly helpful allies that tell us that we're on the right track, right? They're the ones that are not warning signs, but they're cheerleaders. They're not limitations, but invitations. And then number three, they knew that after they got through this wonder hell, there was just another one and another one and another one if they were lucky. So they meted out their energy to make sure that they knew that like everything that went right or went wrong during this wonder hell was just what they used as a foundation to build on the next one and the next one and the next one after that. And so, you know, when you have conversations with Olympic medalists and you're like, okay, so what did you think about on the starting blocks? And they were like, nothing, nothing. Because I already earned my medals in practice. I was just picking them up on race day. Or you talk to somebody who runs a $2 billion company and she's like, I still have imposter syndrome all the time. I just know that when I do it, I'm going to walk in and prove to myself that I'm even better than I was yesterday, right? So all these lessons that you get from people along the way are the ones who have learned that like, look, either you're going to drown in Wonder Hell or you're going to thrive in Wonder Hell. And since the only option is either don't succeed, don't expect more from yourself, or do succeed and do see this potential, I'd rather live in the camp of thriving in Wonder Hell than not.
Interesting. So it's approaching Wonder Hell with an excitement, stepping into it and knowing that, hey, I can do this. It's possible, versus looking at Wonder Hell and going, holy crap, let me sit back and sort of watch rather than actually jump into it. It's putting ourselves into that, believing in ourselves and knowing, and I think such an interesting thing that you just mentioned, where you look at someone who's running a $2 billion company, they're having some of the same thoughts as they step into that wonder hell, they're just stepping into it rather than observing it.
Yeah. And one of the very last story I tell in the book is from Whitney Johnson, who is one of the top business thinkers in the world. And she talks about the S curve, which is like, if you think about an S, like the bottom is sort of flat and you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. This is really hard. And then the S sort of turns up and you're like, oh, I'm figuring it out. Cool. I'm starting to get it. And then the S goes flat again at the top. You're like, I've got it. I'm like mailing it in now. I'm good. I'm like, everything's fine. Yeah. I'm doing all right. And then eventually you get complacent. And I was like, what do you mean you get complacent? Like, you're succeeding. Everything's great. And she's like, no. She's like, there's a certain point at the top of your S curve where if you don't come back with a beginner's mindset and look at it fresh or create a new project or a new opportunity or leave and go to a new company or something, you will start to self-sabotage. And I was like, that can't be true. Like, who self-sabotages when they're successful, right? It sounds kind of ridiculous. So she asked me to tell her a story about a time when I was doing really well that maybe I went to a client not quite as prepared as I should. And as soon as she asked me that question, I remembered the moment when I was 10 years into running my search firm where I walked into a scion of Wall Street. I walked into a scion of Wall Street's office. I mean, this is like Gordon Gekko, like his desk was larger than most conference room tables you see looking out over all of Central Park. And I danced so fancy in that office because I was so ill prepared. I did the shuffle. I did, you name it. I did every dance move you could possibly have. And I sold the work. But man, did I not deserve to sell the work. Like I only sold the work because I'd been doing this work for 15 years at that point. And I knew enough to like pull enough BS out of my behind in order to do it. And I got really lucky. I should not have sold the work. And in that moment, I was like, if this had not gone well, I mean, this was malpractice. Like it would have reflected poorly on me, on my staff, on my firm, on him, on his family, on the foundation he wanted to create. Like that was not a good thing to do. And on the elevator down, I texted my partner and I said, maybe it's time for me to think about leaving. Like I knew in that moment, it was time for me to jump to my next S curve because I had gotten to that point where I was self-sabotaging. So to answer your question, there you can choose to be in Wonder Hell or you can choose to stay out of it. But if you choose to stay out of it, that decision ends up getting made for you anyway.
Yeah. Powerful. Man, I love that idea of the S curve. It's so true, right? Sometimes you get complacent and it's one of those signs. It's one of those silent whispers that's like, hey, maybe there's the next thing and you can wait for it or you can create it. And I think obviously if you create it, you're gonna have a more enjoyable life. So
I mean, look, your podcast is called Finding Direction, right? Yeah. Like you have to find direction because the problem is if you don't find direction, sometimes direction finds you. And when direction finds you, it's usually somebody else handing you their direction. I mean, you know, I told you about my law school experience with a fourth grade teacher. My parents, of course, like, you know, when I was living in Washington, D.C., I tell this story, I joke around. I'm like, when I was living in Washington, D.C., I met the man of my grandmother's dreams, right? Like the man of my grandmother's dreams came in the form of a 6'2", nice Jewish boy named Alan. He was a medical student. He came from a great family, had perfect teeth. He was like the Holy Grail. But the problem with Alan, No Spark Alan, as he became known in my family, is that every time I kissed him, all I could think of was like milk, butter, cheese, eggs. Like I got to start that report. And boy, that dog really needs to be groomed. Yeah. And like, there was just no spark, right? But like, if I listened to my teacher, I would have been a lawyer. If I listened to my grandmother, I would have been Mrs. No Spark Alan, right? Like there are people who hand you these definitions. And when I was at that big firm, I would have listened to my boss's definition, which was the way he wanted to do the work, which was profits first, clients second. And I felt very strongly that it should be clients first and the profits will follow. Yeah. So, you know, at every age and at every stage, somebody's going to hand you direction. Someone's going to hand you a definition of success. And if we don't stop and say, is that definition my definition?
Yeah.
Then not only are we not going to be happy, but we're also not going to be successful because you can't be insatiably hungry for somebody else's goals.
Yeah.
And when somebody else hands you their direction, they're handing you their goals for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So beautifully said. Laura, it's been an absolute honor to have you on the show and pick your brain and hear your story and so much wisdom intertwined through all of it. I'm curious, you know, if our listener wants to hang out with you more, learn more about you, get your book, where's the best place for them to come find you?
Yeah, so my name is Laura Gassner Otting. All my friends call me LGO. So you can find me at Hey LGO on all the socials, HEYLGO. Perfect. Wonder Hell is available at wonderhell.com and Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop, anywhere cool. Fine books are sold.
Love it, love it. And so my last question for you, and we'll put all those links in the show notes, make it nice and easy for everybody. But my last question to you is a question we ask for all of our guests because we want to help our listener find direction, but we believe in also doing it through action. So what would you say is one thing our listener can do in the next 24 to 48 hours to start finding direction in their life?
Yeah, so I would say they should ask themselves this question. Where did my definition of success come from?
Mm.
And is that definition one that actually works for me?
Mm. Amazing. Awesome. Well, Laura, again, thank you so much for being here. Massively appreciate your time. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Congratulations, my friend, on crushing it through another episode here on Finding Direction. Make sure you give yourself a pat on the back, a round of applause, because you are one of the few who is not willing to settle for less than a life that lights up your soul, and that is absolutely something worth celebrating. I hope you take some of the thoughts, ideas, insights from Laura, and I hope you go start executing on them in your life. Maybe it's that you need to stop letting somebody else's plan for your life be your plan for your life. Whatever it is, take something from today, implement it into your life. And other than that, I want to say thank you for being here as always. Make sure if you haven't yet, hit that subscribe button so you can continue hanging out with us on the show. And if you don't want to go anywhere, don't feel like you need to, I have another episode coming up right after this and you can join us there. All right, my friend, until next time, I will talk to you soon.